What is going on, people? It is Too Loud, guys. With me, Daniel Korn.
And myself, Corey Gardner.
How's your week been, Mr. Corey Gardner?
It's been alright. I can't complain, I guess.
How was your reading week?
Too short.
Agreed.
Yep, way too short. Because we need 2 weeks. So I have that first week to be in the mindset of like, I can chill and be on break. Yeah. The second week, so I can be like, all right, I got to seriously get down to work now.
Yeah, it's like how my work ethic usually is, which is like, I'll wake up and I'll have a whole day ahead of me and been like, okay, well, I need to spend like 6 hours doing nothing before I can get into doing work.
Exactly. I got to spend like a week
that,
doing
exactly.
Nothing.
It's like that dragged out into 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. Sure. And I had a shitload of work and I did not do a fair amount of it.
Nor I.
And now I have a bunch to do today and tomorrow.
As I.
Yep. Yep. Alright. Well, that's good.
Yeah. That's nice.
Did you watch the Oscars at all?
A little bit. Like, really, 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 like, fragmented pieces.
Yeah.
I loved the Sacha Baron Cohen spilling Kim Jong-il's ashes on Ryan Seacrest.
Wait, what?
You didn't see that?
No, I watched the whole Oscars.
It was a red carpet. It wasn't in the Oscars.
Oh, okay.
So Sacha Baron Cohen came to the Oscars as his dictator character.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And supposedly had this jar with Kim Jong-il's ash in it. Like, it had, like, a little picture of Kim Jong-il on it. Ryan Seacrest is interviewing him. And at one point in the interview, he just, like, he accidentally spills the ash on Ryan Seacrest. Ryan Seacrest was, like, visibly pissed. So it was really, really funny.
That's really good.
And, like, security guards were, like, waiting because they knew he was going to pull something, I guess. And they, like, pull him away.
Well, yeah, I heard that he wasn't allowed to actually go into the Oscars because they didn't want him showing up as his dictator character.
Well, apparently it was like, it was kind of like a big thing, but then they sort of agreed to let him do it, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was really wondering, because during the Oscars, they were doing these montages. A lot of the Oscars theme was like, hey, everyone, I know you can get movies for free on your phones now, but isn't going to a movie theater really good, guys?
Right, they did like the Cirque du Soleil thing.
Yeah, and they really were trying to push that like, guys.
Which is
guys.
True, the movie theater is sweet.
I like a movie theater, don't get me wrong. I agree that there is something romantic about it.
Yeah.
But it was very desperate, I felt.
Yeah, sure.
Lots of old people being like, we can't adapt, do what you were doing before, oh god. And they were doing these montages of, like, these movie stars being like, you know, what was the first movie you saw and why do you like going to movie theaters and stuff. And Sacha Baron Cohen was one of them, and I was wondering why he was on there when he wasn't allowed to be part of the Oscars.
Yeah, so no, he was at the Oscars.
All right, yeah. Fair enough. Yeah, I watched the whole thing.
Nice. Was it boring?
Emily came over and watched the whole thing. It was pretty boring, yeah. Billy Crystal was not very funny.
Yeah. He wasn't too funny.
The artist won everything.
The artist and Hugo, right?
Yeah.
They each won,
yeah,
like, five.
The artist and Hugo.
I really want to see the artist. I really want to see that movie.
Have heard mixings about the artist.
True.
Everyone
it
I
seems
know,
like something I
Everyone
would like.
I know has really liked it, but a lot of the critics that I like have said, like, yeah, it's good, but not nearly as good as people are saying it is. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
As long as it's good, I'd like to see it.
There's actually a review I would like to link to, which I will do in the show notes, which you can find at twoloudguys.blogspot.com. If you want to check out the stuff
we talk
about.
We talk about movies now.
Yeah.
Two loud movie guys.
Two film guys.
Two film buffs.
Boom. Boom. That. Now that is a name.
All right, let's talk music.
All right. what you been listening to?
You know, just some stuff. I was actually listening to Kiss Alive before I got here.
Attaboy.
I was wondering, because we talked about it last week, how did you listen to that album and not know that Rock and Roll All Night was on it?
I don't know.
it's one of the last two songs. Did
Maybe
you just not
one.
Get to the end
no,
of the
no,
album?
No, I got to the end of the album. I might have fallen asleep near the end of it, though.
I see.
I was on a road trip.
How can you fall asleep?
I was on a road trip to Ottawa.
Okay.
Like, I was driving. Well, I wasn't driving, obviously, because I fell asleep.
Yeah.
But I was in, my parents were driving, and I was in the car, and I guess one thing led to another, and I just ended up falling asleep because I'm really good at falling asleep on moving things.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a skill. It's kind of amazing, actually. So I think I might have fallen asleep during Rock and Roll All Night.
Fair enough. Or maybe it was just during the drum solo.
You know what? That is what I did fall asleep during the drum solo.
Yeah.
And then I woke up.
Oh, so you missed
after.
Cold Gin.
No, I didn't. I woke up
okay.
I woke up for Cold Gin. Yeah. Yeah. I was there.
That album is so exciting because it represents this time where, like, the idea of being a rock star mattered, and it's, like, right in between the hippies and the punks, you know? Like the whole kind of rock star sort of thing, I feel, kind of came out of, like, that post-hippie thing of you know, Led Zeppelin and whoever else was around at the time that kind of made rock stars, like, this big, larger-than-life sort of event.
The Who were rock stars.
And the Who. Like, you know, around, like, before hippies, but especially sort of in the wake of hippies.
I don't think so. I think I disagree with that, because I think there are a lot of bands during the hippies' time that were, you know, definitely rock stars. You had your Janis Joplins, you had your Jimi Hendrixes. Yeah. You know, they're all these
guys. That's what I'm saying. That's where they came from is the point I'm making.
It sort of came
out of the hippie time, but, like, it was really in its most prominent in the mid to late 70s, and, like, Alive sort of captures the excitement of just sort of a big, vapid hard rock show.
It was definitely around the time when music started to get a little heavier. Yeah, and
then it was just kind of right after that where the punks came and made rock stars worthless forever.
You know? I wouldn't say forever.
But they kind of just challenged them showed us that, like, that it's kind of, that the whole thing was kind of silly.
Yeah.
But for that brief period of time, it was just really exciting for everybody.
Yes.
And, like, you know, they had the whole show and the whole, like, the costumes, and what's at the center of it is a solid set of songs and, like, a rhythm guitarist and a lead guitarist who just, like, made some really cool rock and stuff, and then a bassist and a drummer who just had the chemistry to work with what the guitarists were doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's a cool record.
That's cool. I don't have much else to say. I don't want to say anything about Kiss Alive.
Yeah.
I've talked about it for 2 weeks.
Right, we talked about it last week, but I just, like, I wanted to say my last bit on it. It was stuff I didn't,
put it
that
rest.
I missed last week.
Speaking of Kiss, actually, I wanted to talk about Music for the Elders.
Okay, did you listen to it?
No, I didn't.
But you heard it the first half? It was the first few songs, more or less.
Yeah, so we were
going to... We listened to On the Way to Play Dungeons & Dragons.
That's right, actually.
We listened to Kiss's concept album.
It was right after
Mystical.
We recorded last week's episode. We were on our way to our friend's house, and we were listening to get pumped for our night of fantasy adventuring.
Yeah.
We listened to Kiss's
fantasy adventure album.
That album is, like, kind of interesting.
It is.
Like,
That's why I was obsessed with it for a while.
I was kind of digging it. Like, it's so cheesy.
It's real cheesy.
It's amazing how cheesy it is.
Yeah.
But it's, like, you know, it's got some stuff.
It's got things going on. Yeah.
It's got some solos.
You sort of, like, the first three tracks are the ones that are really kind of, like, strange for Kiss. I mean, it's all, the whole album.
Isn't it open with, like, horns also?
Yeah, it opens with, like, an orchestra.
Oh, fucking crazy.
Like, orchestral stuff. But then after those tracks, like, we sort of, where we got to in the album is where it begins to get into more of a rock groove.
Yeah.
But it still sounds more like Rush than Kiss.
Yeah, well, I think it's really funny how 20 years after they toured with Rush, they start sounding a bit like Rush.
That was probably 6 or 7 years, because it was, like, 81 that it came out.
Oh, I thought that album was from, like, the late 80s.
Nah.
Oh,
because it was when they were still wearing makeup.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I see. Yeah. That album is, I mean, obviously I didn't listen to it all the way through, but I was intrigued by it.
You know, as I've said, my biggest problem with it is that it isn't just, like, excessive in the amount of songs. It isn't, like, this, indulgent double disc epic.
It was already starting to wear on me by that fourth or fifth song.
Yeah.
But yeah, I can understand that.
Yeah,
I can understand you wanting it to be this big, super bombastic epic. Like, have its length match its bombast.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I was really intrigued by that album. Not enough to download it, but I was sort of thinking about it.
Yeah.
And then I was like,
yeah,
like, come on. But
I mean, you definitely already heard the most epic part with the first three tracks.
It is an intriguing album. I mean, you can attest to the fact that I was pretty much in disbelief for most of that car ride. I'm like, what?
What's going on?
Here?
Especially now that you've gotten the context by listening to Kiss Alive.
Yeah.
Which is them just at their rockin'est best.
Yeah. All right, what else have you been listening to?
Well, speaking of how Kiss started sounding like Rush in the early 80s, I've been listening to some Rush.
What you been listening to?
First time, I kind of decided that I wanted to, like, start just,
this
like...
Is, this
I've,
is great
I've kind
for
of
me.
More or less been going through their albums, which I've tried to do before, and, you know, and even this run through, as much as I enjoyed it a bit more than I ever have, it had the same problems that they were really that, inconsistent
that,
album.
Yeah, band. That beginning period is pretty rough.
But you know what, like, because I've always been familiar with them through
Chronicles. I feel like, hold on, I feel like I should note here that I'm a huge Rush fan.
Yeah.
And that, like, even though my picture in the logo has an Aquabats logo on it, that's only because I haven't listened, like, I haven't listened intensely to Rush for a couple years.
It would have made more sense if you got the Starman on there, because then it would have been both of us representing our roots in, like, 70s rock.
Yeah, yeah, it's true, but that's why I felt I needed the contrast.
Yeah, yeah,
there.
Definitely.
But yeah, there's I have a deep, deep love of Rush, despite all of their faults.
Yeah. So I decided to act like I kind of more or less started from the beginning, and like I know you don't really like their first album.
No.
I dig it on the grounds that, you know, as much as it was distinctly lacking their drummer Neil Peart and whatever, and, like, you know, all the lyrics and musicianship that he brought to the group, it's
cool.
Well,
I mean, they had the musicianship anyways.
They did,
For John Rutsey, who's a shitty drummer.
Hmm. True. But, yeah, I mean, it's cool because, like, to see their roots as just sort of this, you know, Canadian hard rock band who are just kind of trying to emulate all the power trios and just make, like, bluesy hard rock songs. And
yeah.
Geddy Lee just singing about, you know, banging chicks and all that stuff you sung about in the 70s.
It's kind of neat. Yeah, that song, when it came out, like, people thought it was a new, like, I think their first single was Finding My Way, I think.
It was either that or Working Man.
And, yeah.
And people thought it was,
and people thought it was a new Zeppelin track. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, Geddy Lee really is impressive at that Robert Plant-esque wail.
I mean, he's less cool-sounding about it.
Of course, because he's a geeky version of Robert Plant.
You know, yeah, when I was really into Rush and was like, you don't like Rush? Who? What? How? What? Ah! I used to use that a lot as like, but he sounds like Robert Plant. Robert Plant is cool.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, I mean, the first album's not bad.
Yeah, it has some good tracks on it.
Exactly.
Yeah, but then on Fly By Night, their next album, they bring in Neil Peart. He starts bringing the sort of epic themes and all his crazy Ayn Rand-inspired philosophies.
Yeah.
And so that's when they start getting interesting. And what I sort of realized in that through that is that Rush are at their best when they're constructing epic songs that go above 10 minutes.
See, I'm not sure if I would agree with that.
They have some great, like, they, you know, like, especially on, like, on when they have songs like Spirit of the Radio and Free Will and Limelight and those kind of songs, they do well in the sort of, like, radio rock format. But, you know, like, I know another album you don't really like by them is their third album, Caress of Steel, which is where they start bringing the proggy elements in a lot. And
I don't even really like Fly By Night. Like, Fly By Night, I think half the songs on Fly By Night are really good.
I like By Tor and the Snow Dog, which is the epic on there, is a good song.
Yeah, that song's cool. But
Fly
that song,
By Night's a good song.
By Tor and the Snow Dog is cool, but it's also a lot better live.
Yeah,
than
I would,
it ever was
I'd
on
imagine
record,
so.
When they sort of cut it down a bit.
Yeah, I don't really like that album much either. I find it kind of boring. But Caress of Steel has, firstly, Bastille Day, which is like their
great
most
song.
Rocky
but again,
Led
another
Zeppelin
song.
Rip off.
I think a lot of the problems with those early albums is that the production is so bad on them. Like, they're they're so, like, washed out feeling. Like, there's no color. The drums don't really have, like, a lot of character to them.
Yeah, I could see that.
Just the sound of those albums is it's very dry. And I think it sucks a lot of the life out of those bands that would later be reignited whenever they played live.
Yeah.
You can hear a lot of that stuff on, like, different stages during the third disc, where the third disc of Different Stages is a concert from the 70s.
Right.
And songs like Bastille Day, like, rip on that.
Yeah, I should get their live records.
Yeah.
But Caress of Steel has sort of, like, you know, as much as, like, Fly By Night had one 10-minute epic, Caress of Steel has, like, two nearly 20-minute epics.
Yeah, well, one of them, I think...
And I think they work really, really well.
I think
really
the Necromancer is over 20.
No, I think it's the other one. I think Necromancer is like 12 minutes.
Maybe over 20.
Yeah, that one's like 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And those are both really cool songs. Like, I really like those.
I think those songs have cool sections, and they're interesting in the way they're sort of prototypes for when they would actually master the long form, which is on their next album, 2112.
You know what's weird, though? Is, like, I listened to 2112 on the subway the other day, and I found it kind of boring. I expected it to be way more epic
really?
Than it was. Like, The Temples of Syrinx is an awesome song, which is the only one I was familiar with in 2112. But after that, I kind of, like, I really want to get into it, and I'm going to keep listening to it, but I don't know, there just wasn't a lot going on for me. Felt like half of it was, like, them tuning their instruments.
I think, well, because, you know, there's that one discovery that is actually a part of it.
Yeah, but...
I think that song is a lot better. I think it's just better, they're better at doing the long form, I think, for that song, because... The songs on Caress of Steel... First off, Caress of Steel has Rivendell, which is the worst song Rush has ever made.
You mean Lakeside Park?
No, Rivendell.
Rivendell. That's in between Bastille Day and Lakeside Park. Oh, no, that's I Think I'm
Lakeside
Going
Park
Bald.
Lakeside Park is on... Is
that on Lakeside Park? No, I think Rivendell's on another album.
No. Rivendell is on Caress of
Steel. No, because there's five songs on Caress of Steel. There's Bastille Day, I Think I'm Going Bald, Lakeside Park, and then the two epics.
Isn't Lakeside Park on Five by Night?
I don't think so.
Okay, so maybe it's on... Maybe it's on... Fly by Night, then. It's on one of those two.
Rivendell's probably
that
on
song
Fly by Night.
Is the worst song ever. It's like a terrible, flowery acoustic song with Geddy Lee singing about a bunch of elves fucking dancing around. Like, it's based on Lord of the Rings.
The acoustic part sounds pretty, like, Zeppelin-y, right?
Yeah, but it's bad.
Yeah, I think I kind of like that song.
That song's fucking horrible. Anyways, I think 2112, because the songs on Crest of Steel sort of have these different parts that sort of go together, but they don't really go together all that well.
See, I felt like the songs on 20, like the piece on 2112 didn't seem
to... No, 2112 is excellent.
Not flow.
No, that's why it's so good, because they do such a good job of introducing a bunch of themes in the first part, and then bringing them back in.
That's true.
Near
yeah.
the end.
They do kind of bring back down, like, the rockin' section.
Yeah, it's sort of, I think they've grown a lot on that album, and, like, they sound a lot more confident, mm-hmm. And I think that song is just constructed in a much better way.
I don't know,
way.
I think my expectations for it were really high because it's sort of touted, I don't know how to say that word, as their you know, greatest epic, and it seems to not do a lot for me, but I'm going to listen to it again. I'm most excited to listen to the epics on Hemispheres, which I haven't
have
yet.
Was 2112 the last one you listened to?
No, I kind of skipped over Hemispheres. I listened to a bit of bits of Permanent Waves and Moving Pictures, and those albums both have great singles.
You skipped over Farewell to Kings, then, also.
Yeah, because I already have that one on vinyl, so I'm familiar with Farewell to Kings.
Yeah,
and I
really
like that album.
Yeah, that one's really good. That used to be my favorite one.
Yeah, I've always really dug that album. Because that one they make feel really epic by bringing the sort of more medieval kind of themes into it.
Yeah, that used to be my favorite one before I realized that, like, Cinderella Man is okay, but mm-hmm. not great, and what's the other song on there? No, Tears is on 2112. There's a shitty ballad on Farewell to Kings.
I'm not sure exactly. That's not happening.
But, like, Farewell to Kings is a great song.
Yeah.
Xanadu is a fantastic song.
Again, the epics.
Yeah.
Reigning Supreme.
That album's, And I think that album's really good because it has those two epics that are, like, 10 minutes. Like, they're not full-blown. They're sort of these mini-epics.
Yeah.
I think that works really well.
That's
like,
true.
Cygnus X1 is kind of repetitive, but still cool, mm-hmm. also. So.
Yeah, Permanent Ways of Moving Pictures is sort of also, like, two of their kind of, like, peaks, you know, by critics and fans.
Yeah.
And, again, I just found them really inconsistent. Like, they have great singles, but I wasn't finding a lot to really dig into in the album tracks.
I think Permanent Waves is probably my favorite Rush album.
Really? That's interesting.
I
always thought you would have sort of went for an earlier one, like one of the proggier ones, rather.
I would have probably said, a while ago, I would have said Farewell to Kings, but I think Permanent Waves does a really good job of mixing, like, of because that's sort of when they grew, when, like, Hemispheres was sort of their big prog thing where they got, like, the most into prog, and they have this
huge
concept idea with, like, these two different gods representing different sides of the brain fighting, and it also ties into this earlier song about fucking space travel, and it's really crazy because, like, Hemispheres is part two of Cygnus X1.
Oh yeah,
from Farewell to Kings, or it's supposed to be, and it ties in very loosely with the plot of that song. So it's them really going overboard with the prog thing.
Well, have you ever heard of the Fear series?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a really interesting concept.
Yeah.
It's like they have these four songs that are part of a series, but they all show up on, like, different albums and, like, in different times. Like, part one is on a later album than part two.
Yeah, part four is on Vapor Trails.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It seems as if they made this concept up as they went along.
Oh, they did. Like, because I think Fear 1 is, I think, Witch Hunt.
Yeah.
But it's not called that on the album. They sort of, like, retroactively went back.
Did any of them actually have the title of Fear? I think that they all sort of have their own titles.
Yeah, they do. They have their own titles, but then in later albums it says, like, part two of Fear, or part three of Fear. Whereas I think for Witch Hunt, they sort of retroactively went, like, oh, yeah, That's part one.
Yeah, true. Makes sense.
What was I gonna say about? Oh yeah. So Pregnant Waves is sort of where they're still being proggy, but it's where they decide to be like an arena rock band.
Yeah, and I mean Spirit of the Radio encapsulated that so beautifully. Yeah. I think that's my favorite classic rock song.
I love ever. Spirit of the Radio. I think Spirit, it's such a well constructed song. Yeah. Like it's so perfect.
Well, it's so important to me too because when I was sort of getting into classic rock and stuff, it was while I was, you know, entering my teenagehood, and yeah. I'll always remember the day before my bar mitzvah, I got sort of my, you know, I had these,
the day before you became a man.
Exactly. I had some classic rock CDs, which were the Alice Cooper CDs that my dad sort of passed on to me, but that was sort of the only thing I listened to for a while. And I got Dark Side of the Moon by Pink Floyd and Rush Chronicles the day before my bar mitzvah, and like, I listened to Rush Chronicles, and, like, I listened to Spirit of Radio over and over again, because I heard that song on Q107, our classic rock station here, all the time, and I just thought it was the most, like, incredible song, and so, like, to this day, it just has such warm memories. It's just so, it's such a beautiful song about, like, integrity in rock music, and, but it's just, like, epic and rock, and it has this weird, like,
great
reggae
riff.
Section at
great
the
riff,
end.
Yeah, yeah, weird reggae riff. Section, that song is just so great. Yeah. Fucking amazing solos by Alex Lifeson.
Yeah. Oh, like, seeing that man. Live must just be mind-blowing.
Oh, it's great. Yeah. Have you never seen a video of it live?
No.
We'll watch one when we're done here. It's really good.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, it has Spirit of Radio. It has Free Will on it, which has that middle part where Geddy Lee goes, like, way high, which is maybe a little bit too much, but that song's really good.
Yeah.
It has Natural Science, which is a great little mini-epic.
I don't even remember what that one sounds
like. It's right near the end. Well, it has two. It has that, and it has Jacob's Ladder. And Jacob's Ladder is mostly instrumental. Sort of, and
true.
It's like 7 or 8 minutes long. That song's cool. It has those two, like, it has Entre Nous and Different Strings, which are both, like, sort of not great pop songs, but I really like Permanent Waves.
That's the thing about their album. I guess that's why I'm sort of associating their epics with being their best songs, because, like, on the albums that have epics, it seems like the short songs on those albums pale in comparison to the epics on the albums.
Yeah, you're right.
And that's what makes them feel really kind of inconsistent.
Yeah, like,
weird.
What do you think about 2112's other tracks?
Yeah, they're just kind of, like, they're pretty nondescript for me.
There's one really good one on there. What's the Passage of Bangkok is on there.
That's a good song.
Good track.
But I've heard live versions of it that
are
so much
better.
Better.
Yeah.
And I dip my toes into their early album, 80s albums, when they
began.
Well,
I want to talk about Moving Pictures a bit, actually,
okay.
Since you're on the topic. I didn't like Moving Pictures when I first heard it. That was the first Russian album I heard, and it was when I was getting really
into
drummers.
You know, I don't even think I listened to the songs off there that I don't already know yet. Because, like, the first three tracks are, like, Tom Sawyer, YYZ.
And Red Barchetta.
Red Barchetta. And then
Limelight,
which is, like, four tracks that I already knew.
Yeah.
I don't think I listened to the second half of it.
Oh, see, that's... Okay, so here's my thing with Moving Pictures. I listened to it originally because I was getting into, like, I started to get into, like, drums more, so I heard about Neil Peart, and I was like, oh, I should probably go listen to some Rush, and I went through my dad's CD collection, and he had Moving Pictures on CD, so I listened to it, and I, like, didn't really like it. And then I saw School.
Like, you didn't even like Tom Sawyer?
No, like, I was like, oh, that's a really cool drum fill and a drum break, but, like, I wasn't into it. I didn't like the sound, I was coming off of really getting into, like, Foo Fighters and Sum 41 and stuff, so hearing this sort of older, weird-sounding rock at the time for me was sort of weird.
I know, that's how I felt when I first started listening to Alice Cooper, where it was like, I was getting used to the idea of sort of, like, what I believed to be metal at the time, which was, like, radio metal, that heavy guitar sound.
Yeah, and you're like, what is
like,
this?
I was like, this isn't heavy, this sounds like... pussy rock.
it's
weird.
So I didn't like Moving Pictures very much at first, and then I saw School of Rock, and on School of Rock, Jack Black gives the drummer kid 2112.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, I'll go give 2112 a shot, and I bought it, and like I loved 2112, and that was how I got into Rush, and then I went back to Moving Pictures and liked it.
Yeah.
But I still think, like, Moving Pictures, the problem with it is that the first four songs, amazing.
Yeah.
All amazing songs.
Yeah.
Then you have The Camera Eye, which is a 10-minute epic. But it's a weird 10-minute epic because it's not really constructed like their other ones. It doesn't. It feels almost more like how Led Zeppelin do their 10-minute epics.
Which is how?
Which is that Led Zeppelin's epics don't really have different sections or different movements.
Right, they sort of are still structured like pop songs.
They sort of are still structured like verse, chorus. They're just really long.
Yeah.
And The Camera Eye is sort of like that. I have grown to really like that song, but it's... it's not like their other songs, and it's kind of repetitive, and if you don't like it, I totally understand.
Yeah.
And the last two songs of that album are not very good at all.
Which is Witch Hunt.
Witch Hunt, which is a shitty song, and Vital Signs, which a lot of Rush fans like a lot, and I've never understood why. Hmm. It sort of signals, because it's sort of this weird reggae-ish song, so it sort of signals a lot of their, what their later 80s stuff would be like.
Yeah.
And I don't like it at all. A lot of people like that song a lot, and I never really got why.
Yeah. So, yeah, so that album's where they sort of, like, really began incorporating synths. Yeah. But then after that is where synths took over the place of guitars, basically.
Signals is kind of split.
Signals sounded a bit more split. But then Grace Under Pressure like, brings a synth in usually. Yeah. And I basically skimmed those two albums. I haven't really listened to them so far. But I actually like Grace Under Pressure more than Signals.
Really?
Yeah.
I think Signals...
It had a pretty interesting sound.
I think Signals is a really good album.
Mm-hmm.
I think Signals... mixes that keyboard stuff with some more guitar. It's still, it's very, like, Rush in the early 80s.
Yeah.
Like, it's very 80s Rush.
Yeah.
But I think it's before they go over the deep end of having too much synth.
Yeah,
and it still has some really good tracks.
And I guess I almost kind of weirdly liked the too much synth sound on Grace Under Pressure because it has, you know, cool songs like, what's the first song on there? Like, that's a single that's really good.
Oh, Distant Early Warning?
Yeah, I like that song. That's
a
cool song.
That's the thing, is that Grace Under Pressure, that was kind of dated. Like,
it's super dated.
All their 80s stuff
and
is
like,
pretty dated.
It's interesting because I feel like at the time, it might have had a kind of almost oppressive sound.
Yeah, well, it does.
But it sounds just cheesy.
That song
now,
is very cold. Like, it has,
yeah,
doesn't,
exactly.
Isn't Red Sector A on that album?
It might be. It's
that
either on that or Signals.
Like, that album's a song about the Holocaust and shit.
Yeah.
And, like, a lot of that album's
makes sense.
Lyrical themes is about, like, man having too much power and like nuclear warfare. It's very like Cold War kind of album.
Yeah, it feels that way. And
it's got this very cold, like, you know, light blue color palette.
What's
to it.
Weird about it is when they sort of incorporate those like reggae and funk elements, because that's when it sounds the most dated.
Yeah,
and it just kind of sounds like nerdy white guys trying to play funk.
Guys
it's
who
really
just listen
weird.
To too much Police.
Yeah, I guess that's what it is.
Really,
I guess
the
it's
problem.
The Police influence that makes perfect sense.
The thing with a lot of those 80s albums is that like. They're all really super keyboardy.
Yeah.
And then
I'm afraid
have...
to go past Grace Under Pressure.
Yeah, you shouldn't.
Like,
go
I don't
past
want
Grace
it.
Under
the
Pressure.
Power Windows or Hold
no,
Your Fire.
No, you shouldn't. I actually, to this day, I have not listened to Hold Your Fire. It's the one Rush album I've not listened to because I've just heard too many bad things about it.
Yeah.
Which is funny because I've heard a lot of live recordings of a lot of those songs, and live, they're really good. Like, have you
heard because Rush was still a great band in the 80s, I imagine.
No,
that
no, not from the
80s. Great.
Like, their songs, their performances
from
now.
I see.
Of those songs where they sort of toughen them up and give them some, like, nice guitar shit. Have you ever heard Force 10?
Only the version on Chronicles, which is a live one, I think. Oh, no, maybe it's a studio one.
It's probably a studio one. So that's a song from Hold Your Fire, and that song on Hold Your Fire sucks balls, but they do a version on R30... And it's fucking awesome. And it's like,
I think you've actually showed it to me before. And
it
was a lot cooler.
Really, really good. I mean, after Signals, sort of all the albums from the 80s have maybe one or two good songs on them. And then the rest are just sort of things that make you go like, ugh. And I used to support those albums. I used to be like, yeah, you know, they're still better than a lot of other bands. Bad material.
Yeah.
And they kind of still are. Like,
because Rush are always a class act.
Yeah. Yeah, they were always kind of classy, even when they were pussies.
Yeah.
And even when, like, Alex Lifeson stopped being in the band.
Yeah.
But...
Well, he was a good sport about it, at least.
I mean,
I don't know anything about
natural
history. Yeah,
there was a lot of tension,
imagine,
especially near the end of the 80s, where, like, there was a lot of Alex Lifeson being like, what am I even doing in this band? And, like, them almost breaking up, and a lot of fighting between, like, Alex Lifeson trying to figure out where he sort of fit in as a player, and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It's a weird time. It was a weird time for everyone in the 80s.
Yeah, it's true.
And are you planning to go any further? Are you going to go into the 90s stuff at all?
I've considered it. I keep considering it, and I'm afraid that I'm just going to be bored. And then I need to really get the 70s stuff
before
I can move
you
on
do.
To the 90s
you
stuff.
You do. Because I feel like my relation to Rush is very similar to yours
with
Kiss.
Kiss, exactly.
Where I'm such a big fan of theirs
that
I
like everything they do.
Yeah, where I can sort of acknowledge that a bunch of albums by them are not that good, but I still like them a lot.
Yeah.
Except for those 80s ones. And, like, I don't listen to 90s Rush almost ever, but, like, there's some good, like, I think Counterparts is a really good album.
Because that's when they brought the guitar back and stuff, right?
They were sort of bringing it back on Presto, which is a 1989 release.
See, I listened to a bit of that, and it just sounded pretty bad. It sounded, like, bland.
Presto is bland. It's not bad, but it is very bland.
Yeah.
Presto and Roll the Bones are both quite bland. And Roll the Bones has that ill-advised rap part in it.
Right, I've read about that.
Have you not? You never heard it? Don't you have Russian Rio?
No.
Oh, you should get... That's what you should get.
Yeah, I should get Russian Rio.
You should just get Russian Rio and, like, dig that album for a while. Because that gives you a really good span. It's three CDs, and it gives you a really good idea, Rio, and that'll give you a good overview of some of their lesser-known and less well-regarded stuff.
Yeah.
Right on. But yeah, Counterparts is sort of their grunge album, because it's 1994. So it's like them reacting to grunge, and it's kind of...
Is it successful?
It's not bad. Like, it's pretty heavy. Like, it's very, like, it's sort of their first... It's like a hard rock album. Right. You know? Like, it's very 90s hard rock sounding. It sounds really organic. There's some nice songs on there.
Cool.
I think that's a cool album that you might do well to check out. And then Test for Echo was kind of meh.
Yeah, even the album cover of that one just makes it look...
Yeah, Again, it's an album that has a couple good songs on it, but most of it is not good. And then Neil Peart has this whole tragedy thing. Right. They don't come back until Vapor Trails, which I still think is maybe their best album.
Yeah, that's an album that you've always sort of been on about. And whenever I try to listen to it, it still sounds kind of boring to me.
The reason why Vapor Trails is an album that I constantly go back to is that it's the only Rush album that is consistent all the way through. Like, yeah, it's the only Rush album. Like, that album is still too long. But it's too long, but each song is really good.
Hmm.
And it's probably their most consistent album.
Yeah, it's really a shame that their 70s albums are all so inconsistent.
Yeah.
Because they are, like, the most rocking power trio, you know, this side of the Jimi Hendrix experience.
Yeah,
it's really a shame.
Yeah, and are you gonna, have you checked out Snakes and Arrows at all?
I figure I'll get there eventually.
Snakes and Arrows is pretty good.
Yeah.
Good sounds. Boring live. When I saw them live, I've only seen them once live. I really should have seen them the last time. I should have seen them the last time they came through because they were doing more of a retrospective tour.
Right.
But for the Snakes and Arrows tour, I saw them. And the problem with it was that they were bringing back a lot of obscure songs that fans would have wanted to hear. But they were obscure songs that, like, you know, fans want to hear them because they're obscure and they don't get played live a lot, but they're not the best songs, really. And they played a lot of Snakes and Arrows, like almost all of it.
Yeah.
And that album's pretty good. It's pretty solid. They do some really good textural things on it, and it's a good, it's a good example of a rock band, of an old rock band aging very well and still doing new things and that kind of thing. And that album sounds great. It has, the longtime Foo Fighters producer whose name is Nick Rasculinez or something. But live, those songs, because a lot of those songs are sort of mid-tempo and slower, it's like live, it's pretty boring, and it's a bit of a shame.
Yeah.
But, they have a new album coming out, I think, this year.
Sweet.
Yeah, I'm curious to see what that's going to be like.
Probably like Snakes and Arrows. I mean, maybe not.
I don't know, because Snakes and Arrows wasn't like Vapor Trails.
Yeah, but it was also so many years after, right?
Yeah, this is a lot of years after Snakes and Arrows.
I guess, because that was like 2007 already. 2007,
yeah, it's 5 years.
Yeah.
Same distance from Vapor Trails to Snakes and Arrows.
Hmm.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what they do with that.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
We've been talking about Rush for a long time.
Hell yes, we have. You know, I fucking deserve this shit.
Yeah, that's cool,
I have
cool,
to put
man.
Up with you talking about Kiss like every goddamn week.
Yeah, so nothing wrong with that.
I deserved having 20 minutes to talk about Rush.
I did not mind.
All right, what else have you been listening to?
Hmm.
You got anything else?
That's my list. I've been listening to a great, great, great EP that I'm so stoked about. It is the Haji Beats Untitled EP.
Nice. I have not heard it yet.
Okay, so Haji Beats is one of the members of Odd Future Wolfgang, Kill Them All, who, of course, you know, Tyler, the Creator, is their very popular leader. And Haji Beats was, you know, he's one of the kind of three members who... Well, he's interesting because he sort of falls in between the two members who talk about, like, crazy shit, like, and violence and rape and evil shit, and then the two members who just kind of talk about chilling and smoking weed. And, like, he sort of does a little bit of both.
Well, his stuff is very... It's very sort of typical gangster. Like, it doesn't
sometimes.
Go as... It doesn't go as overboard as something like Tyler or Earl does.
Yeah.
But he, you know, a lot of his stuff is about violence and money, which is not a thing that comes up a lot in other Odd Future releases. Like, he talks about... the sort of hip-hop gangster lifestyle a lot. Like, he talks about robbing people and vile and just sort of...
But at the same time, he does it in kind of, like, silly ways.
Yeah, sometimes a lot of time he'll throw in lines that sort of are just these sort of ridiculous things that undermine the toughness that he sort of is trying to bring out.
But and he will still sometimes go into that sort of, like, satanic direction. And then at the same time, he'll sometimes go into a really conscious direction. Like, there's the occasional track on Mellow Hype albums where he's actually just kind of talking about, you know, the world and, like, and stuff and stuff that no other members of Odd Future would ever kind of touch. And sort of, like, the kind of stuff that sort of, like, you expect from, you know, a conscious rapper.
Yeah. And socially conscious is sort of what
socially conscious, yes. And that's what's so beautiful about this EP is that that's sort of what he's addressing. And he's still sort of just having fun on the tracks and stuff, but he's actually kind of trying to sort of have content there.
Yeah.
And it comes off really well because he has a set of, like, great soulful beats that just make it sound more like quote-unquote real hip-hop than anything else that Odd Future have released.
So he's not sort of... You don't feel like he's missing out by not having Left Brain producing for him?
For once, no. And that's what's so great, because that is how I felt on the last two Odd Future releases. You know, Domo Genesis and Mike G both released stuff that were... I mean, I guess the Mike G release even did have kind of Odd Future affiliates producing.
Yeah, yeah.
But they were still both really underwhelming and disappointing. And this feels like it's actually really got something going for it. Like, I've already listened to it, like, 5 times, you know. It's nice length, 20
minutes.
Yeah,
I wanted to check it out right before this podcast, but I didn't have time, unfortunately.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, sometimes he still sounds a bit too close to Lil Wayne and how he flows, but he's, you know, lyrically already just leagues ahead of Lil Wayne as far as I'm concerned.
I've heard really good things about this EP, actually.
Yeah.
Especially from people who, and a lot from people like on Sputnik who were like sort of becoming disillusioned with Odd Future.
Yeah.
A lot of people like that who are being like, okay, no, but this is pretty good.
Exactly, because as much as I've been kind of getting back into Odd Future, I've still been so disillusioned since Goblin.
Yeah.
But this definitely brought me back to the full.
Have you seen
the new album?
Have you seen the trailer for Loiter Squad?
No.
It looks weird.
In a good way?
I can't tell.
Loiter Squad's the MTV show that Odd Future are going to be. Oh, Adult Swim, right.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know how I feel about it. It looks kind of dumb.
Yeah, I sort of expected as much. Like, they're smart kids, but they like to indulge in being dumb.
Yeah.
That's kind of the interesting dichotomy of Odd Future.
Yeah. I actually listened to some Odd Future. It was just the track, though. Did you hear Rella?
Yeah.
What did you think of Rella? Rella is a track that they released that's going to be on their... upcoming release Odd Future Volume 2.
Yeah. And I mean, you know.
Yeah, that's
like,
sort of how I felt.
Like, it's got a cool-ish beat.
Yeah.
It's got, you know, Domo Genesis and Haji Beats both kind of are spitting nothing.
Okay,
just, like,
there's...
sort of whack stuff with a few good lines that are just kind of fun and silly. And Tyler, the Creator's raps are kind of just as mediocrely written.
I like
but his flow is always a pleasure.
Yeah, exactly. I like... That song is good because it sort of is just kind of going for a minute and a half, and then Tyler comes in, and when Tyler comes in, it really picks up.
Yeah,
because
exactly.
It's just
it
nice
always
to
picks
have
up Tyler's
voice
in
there. He's always got that a really nice contrast to everyone else's voice.
I guess it worries me a bit because it's kind of like hard mainstream rap kind of track, and it worries me because I'm so excited for this new Odd Future release, but I'm afraid that it's going to be more that side than all their other sides.
I'm going to put something by you. I don't think that album's gonna be good.
Oh, I hope that's not gonna be the case.
I don't think it's gonna be good. I think it'll be fine at best.
My expectations for it are probably too high.
I think here are my predictions, and if I'm wrong on this, well, some of them are gonna be good, and some of them will be bad. So whatever. So here's what I think.
Yeah,
I think Odd Future Tape Volume 2 is not gonna be very good. I think Mellow Hype's album is going to be really good.
Yeah, I mean, if this Haji Beats EP is any indication, then new Mellow Hype's going to have to be
I think
great.
New Mellow Hype is going to be really good. I think they're going to come back and, like, really, really do a good job on it.
Yeah.
And then I think Wolf could go either way.
Is Wolf just, like, a sequel to Goblin, or is Wolf the weird hippie music Tyler wants to make, or is that another project?
I think it's the weird hippie
music
he wants to make.
Then I'm excited for it.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Speaking of hip hop, I actually forgot to write this down, but I was listening to I didn't get to listen to too much this week. I feel like I should point out I had
a lot
of work.
That basically what I just mentioned is everything I've listened to this week.
Yeah, I had a ton of work and
Yeah, well, that the last thing I listened to is something I forgot about last week.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anyways, I had a lot of work this week, and I wasn't out of my house that much, which means I was not listening to that much music, because I usually listen to music when I'm out of the house, because mm-hmm. that's how it works. So, but when I was checking out the Hieroglyphics album. Do you know Hieroglyphics?
Cool. Yeah.
So they're
the funky Homo Sapiens crew.
Yeah, they're a crew of 90s...
Probably early 2000s.
You think?
Yeah.
I'm dumb. I didn't do my research. I don't know who else. I don't know who the other rappers are on it.
And I don't care because I don't like any of them.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know. Whenever I've heard their tracks, I just find the other rappers so dull.
No, you know what? I think they contrast really well with Del's flow.
Maybe I should re-listen to it.
I think it's good. I should note that I did not get a chance to listen to the whole album. I probably got through the first half or the first three quarters or something. But it's pretty good. Like, it's not... Del is a shame.
Del is the biggest shame in hip hop.
Because Del is a great
rapper. I'm glad
you
said that.
And he's probably my favorite. In terms of flow, he's probably my favorite rapper.
Right on.
But, like, he doesn't have any good albums.
Yeah.
Except for Deltron.
Exactly. Deltron is great. So beautifully. It's his epic album. You know, he got Dan the Automator just giving him the best stuff. And this whole wacky concept and futuristic sci-fi stuff. But, yeah, all his other albums are really weak.
Yeah.
And he is such an incredible writer of rap lyrics and such a great voice
and
flow.
I think the
But
problem,
his songs aren't there.
I think the thing that happens that it's problematic is that he, whenever he has a concept for a song, like a real idea, a real theme, it always works really well. Like, on Both Sides of the Brain, that has If You Must, which is an incredible song.
Right, yeah, that's a really good track.
Yeah, that song's great, where he's talking
hygiene.
About... hygiene. Yeah, and there's another track on there where he's talking about, like, booze and weed, and sort of the differences between them.
Interesting, I mean, that so long, I don't remember any of it.
Fair enough.
I was doing ears.
And that track's really good, too. But, like, he resorts too much to just sort of, like, I'm just going to boast about myself for a little while now.
And, you know, he's definitely kind of influenced by the old school of hip-hop in that regard, but it gets really grating.
But, it's just that when he puts his mind to something, when he puts his mind to like, okay, for this song, I'm going to talk about this.
Yeah.
It usually works really well. But he doesn't really do that much, so the other tracks that he has are always sort of meh.
Yeah. And the old thing about rappers who just boast is kind of like, all the raps are about boasting, but they back it because they have the skills. And Del backs his boasting because he could probably beat anybody in a rap battle.
Yeah.
But it's like in this modern world of hip-hop where we've gone so beyond that, it just gets really boring to listen to.
It's a real shame also because Del is a very smart guy. Like, he's always trying to push himself and do new things and stuff. He has a new album coming out this year, I think. Which is his first in a long time.
Yeah. I don't know, like, maybe even since... No, not since Both Sides of the Brain. He's released a few things since then. But, yeah.
So the reason why I think Hieroglyphics really works is that Del is just one member.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have him coming in once in a while, when he comes in, it's really strong and great. And then the other times, you have these other rappers who actually are pretty good in their own right.
Yeah, I should realize it. Like, to me, it just kind of sounded like such typical underground rap that it bored me, but now I get more into
it. It's not the best. What's the other one? Souls of Mischief seems like it could be better.
Hmm.
I think Souls of Mischief
Souls of Mischief is also. Oh, no, it's not.
Is it not? No, never mind then. I don't know what I'm talking about. I always thought that was Del for some reason. Did he produce on that or something?
He might have collaborated with them or something.
I think he did, because Tal was talking about it when he was on the podcast, and he mentioned Del Funky Homo Sapien in relation to Souls of Mischief.
Okay.
So I feel like he might be part of it. I think Del's a really good guest star. He's a really good member.
Yeah.
But on himself, he just never quite...
Except on Deltron, which is too long, but you know,
but great.
It's allowed.
Deltron is really damn
good. Concept album.
Deltron is really good.
Yeah, Deltron just has like some of my favorite hip hop songs ever.
It's great.
Have you listened to his first album? I Wish My Brother George Was Here.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, it's not great, but, like, it works because it's fun and funky, and a lot of the songs do have themes.
But it's still, like,
it's frustrating.
I just want you to come out with something that's really damn good.
Yeah. Hopefully when he releases a sequel to Deltron 3030.
I think that's what's coming out this year. I think maybe the Deltron sequel is coming out this year.
I think the Mad Villain sequel is coming out really soon.
Really?
Yeah.
But...
Which is another hip-hop classic, modern classic.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. Cool. Yeah. I still have not delved into Doom.
You should. He's so good. Yeah, I mean, I've gotten really into Mad Villain
this
lately.
I think I did listen to Mad Villain, and I thought it was pretty good.
Yeah, I remember you and I agreeing at one point that it was kind of overrated and not that great. But like lately, when I've been listening, I'm like, this is like Madlib producing Doom really is just an makes for an.
It's a good combo. It's a good combo. But yeah. I guess it was a thing where I went in there with such high expectations
that a lot of albums are that. It's interesting where you go in with such high expectations and it disappoints, and then you listen to it again a lot later, and it's sort of like, well, now, separated from my expectations, I kind of am able to enjoy this a bit
more.
Sure. Which kind of would happen for Goblin with me, I guess.
I was going to say something else about... Oh, yeah. I'm not listening to Doom. I would listen to Doom this week, but I've decided that this week I'm going to be delving into Kanye.
Nice, that's a good call.
So I'm, yeah.
But yeah, after that, you should listen to like the first two MF Doom albums. Yep. In fact, you should listen to all three MF Doom albums, because they're all really great.
I can't absorb hip-hop albums that quickly, though.
True, yeah.
They take, like, I need time to, like, look
at it. You should probably go in order. Yeah. Like, you should start Operation Doomsday, then with Food, and then it was, like, a long, because he's always releasing stuff under different pseudonyms, it was a long time until he came back to Doom with Born Like This, and that's another excellent album.
Yeah. Yeah, do you have anything else you want to talk about?
There was an album last week I forgot to mention that I had listened to.
What was that?
And it's called For Lack of a Better Name, which is a funny title for an album. It was after the Grammys that I listened to it, after Deadmau5's performance. It's a Deadmau5 album.
Oh, okay, cool. That's interesting, because I was thinking about delving into Deadmau5 just because I think I like that dude.
Yeah, well, exactly. Like, after that show, like, you know, he played some cool beats.
Yeah.
And his mask is really, really, really cool.
His mask is really cool.
Like, it's this LED thing, and it just got, like his facial expression is, like, always, like... fading into like different phases. I don't know, it's really trippy. Like, I was just thinking, like, man, if I was
seeing a really cool mask
live, that would just trip me.
So, how's that album?
Disappointing.
Bummer.
Real bummer. Like, I really wanted to get into it, and like, I wanted to just have like just really good, like, pump up kind of stuff, and it was just kind of boring. And like, on the third track, there's a guest feature from like a singer. And that was it for me. I was like, oh, man. Like, because so much electronic music with, like, vocals just ends up sounding really shitty because it was, like, really poppy.
Yeah.
And this track sounded that way.
That's a shame.
It was a real shame.
And is that supposed to be, like, his sort of best album?
It was his breakthrough album. Not necessarily, like, his best, but he's kind of pretty prolific.
I feel like Deadmau5 is a guy where, like, you really want to go see him.
That's exactly what I was just going to say, is that he must be all about the live experience. And it made me think, like... You know, like, what the sort of cliche about Kiss Alive is that the reason it sort of stands how it does the test of time or whatever is that what they say about it is it kind of captured what was missing from Kiss's studio albums was the excitement of feeling the crowd there.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's what's missing from a lot of electronic music in the studio. And what made me think about it is that Daft Punk have this, you know, Alive 1977, their live album, is incredible. And because you feel the energy of what it feels like, the live experience of the music. And I think that as much as Deadmau5 needs to be seen live, I feel like if you got a good quality soundboard live recording of his stuff, it might work better.
Yeah.
Because it's him just mixing stuff live and you kind of feel the energy of him feeding off of a crowd rather than just creating stuff for the studio.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting thing that I feel like, and he is not nearly the same thing as what we're talking about here, but, like, I feel like Girl Talk does a really good job of making, like, albums that just pump you up, even though you're not in a live experience.
But I'd say the mashup quality is a part of that.
Yeah,
it's not really original music.
Yeah. Okay. So I have a couple other things I listened to this week. Oh, okay, the biggest thing was that I got Roar's new EP in the mail.
Do you know when that's going to be up for download? Because I'm so excited to listen to this.
I was going to email Owen Evans and ask him if I could play a track, and then I realized that it's not on the internet, so I can't play a track from it.
Yeah.
So that song is called, that album's called I'm Not Here to Make Friends. Really good.
Yeah, let's explain who Roar are.
So Roar is a one-man, he's one dude named Owen Evans. He sort of... Low Pro came out with this EP
on quote unquote records
in 2010 called I Can't Handle Change, and it was an album that, like, had no hype, no one knew what it was, and it was just, like, this revelation, like, such a unique album, mm-hmm. drawing in a lot of influence from, like, 60s pop.
60s and 70s.
Yeah, 60s and 70s pop, and sort of sounded like this mix between, like, the Unicorns and Electric Light Orchestra and the Beach Boys.
Yeah.
Just, like, this so very singularly unique.
And, like, emo, but I guess sort of Unicorns, kind of.
Is it emo?
Like, I mean, not emo so much as more a general alternative rock ambience.
Sure.
But, like, I feel like there's kind of, there's got to be a bit of emo influence in there.
Maybe.
Especially in the track I Can't Handle Change.
Sure.
Not so much on the rest of the album.
I feel it's more a lyrical.
Lyrical, but I mean, lyrical and, like, vocally, I guess.
I disagree.
Like, there's all the harmonies and stuff, but when he's just singing solo, he kind of has an interesting kind of whiny thing going on.
Yeah, but it's also masked behind all of this, like, 60s kind of reverb, so...
It's true, it's, yeah.
I never got that emo vibe from it. Mm-hmm. So their newest EP, first off, it's important to note that their first album is an EP that is 6 tracks long, and it clocks in at about 15 minutes.
6 glorious tracks.
Yeah. This one is 4 tracks long. So
oh,
it's
really?
Shorter. It only clocks in maybe 10 minutes. Hmm. To put things into perspective, the first one is a 10-inch record. This one is a 7-inch.
I see.
So I got that in the mail. I don't know when it comes out on the interwebs, but it'll probably be on quote-unquote, I imagine, soon.
Yeah.
And it's really good.
As good as I Can't Handle Change?
It's different. It's it's darker.
Interesting.
It's darker, and it's more overtly Beach Boys-y.
Ooh, I like
it's sort
the,
of,
the idea
yeah.
of those two things being what they're doing.
Yeah, it feels like a lot of late period Beach Boys. Like, it feels sort of like Smile
yeah.
and that sort of vibe of, like, this sort
cool.
of unsettling but pretty harmonies kind of thing. Mm-hmm. When I was listening to it, I was like, oh, this is something that would sort of fit in pretty well with, like, Elephant Six.
Yeah, that's how I always felt about I Can't Interchange It. It was, like, the masterpiece that Elephant Six never released.
See, I was... I sort of felt that a little bit, like, I could see where that comes from, but I never exactly felt that. Whereas for this one, I was like, this could definitely be an Elephant Six release
yeah.
if it was gonna be. But it's really good. The last track on it specifically is breathtaking.
Cool.
Whether or not it's better than I Can't Handle Change, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
The trade-off is that because it sounds more, like, even more 60s influence, it sort of loses a bit of that really unique feel mm-hmm. to it. Which isn't a bad thing, necessarily, but I feel like it's less of a surprise than the first one was.
Yeah, but I mean, a sophomore
yeah, exactly.
release is always going to feel that way anyway. Yeah.
Yeah, and it does feel like I wish there was more of it.
Yeah.
You know, it's a bummer when you wait 2 years for a follow-up and it's like this thing that's shorter than the original 15-minute thing.
Yeah.
You know? But, yeah, I'm not disappointed by it in the slightest.
Do you know, like, does that guy really do... Good. Does he have other bands? Or?
No. He probably just has a day job or, you
yeah,
know, like, he's got a...
I guess so.
That's it. But Roar are hopefully going to build some steam now that they're on tour.
Yeah,
because
they're, like, touring with Andrew Jackson Jihad
and
Laura
Stevenson,
right?
Who are both bands that have quite a...
But that
quite
tour's
a,
not coming here.
No.
Damn shit.
They're both bands that have quite a cult following.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping that will build their audience a bit. And
yeah.
It's great that he's even going on tour.
Yeah, true.
And hopefully that means he will one day roll around to Toronto.
Yeah, it would be nice if he kind of ends up really becoming prolific and building up a big
cult
it. Following.
I'd be great. I will, you know, Roar is one of those bands where, like, I will listen to anything it comes up because I'm so interested in what he's bringing out that, like, even if something doesn't strike me immediately the first time, I will keep going back to that album because I like that guy a lot.
Yeah.
And I like what he's doing. So I really hope this brings out sort of...
Even Jeff Rosenstock agreed that it was the best thing they released,
yeah.
quote-unquote.
Yeah, it's his favorite thing on quote-unquote, and it's very true.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's some... It's pretty good. I'm excited to get your thoughts on it.
Yeah, I'm excited to hear it.
Yeah. A couple other things I checked out. I checked out the Gorillaz track with James Murphy.
I wanted to listen to that,
came out.
But I just didn't yet.
That track's called Do Ya Thang.
It's a good track.
It's good, man. Like,
does it have a classic Gorillaz feel?
Yeah, it sounds a lot like Gorillaz. Andre rocks on it. Like, good. He pulls out a good verse on it.
Good, because he hasn't rapped in so long.
Yeah, he gets a good rap on in there. And it does. You know, my problem with Plastic Beach, as I've said many times, is that it doesn't feel like a Gorillaz album. Mm-hmm. There's too many collaborators on it.
And, I mean, that one feels a lot more like a Gorillaz album than The Fall. I've just heard a few tracks, and it just isn't a Gorillaz album. Yeah.
This sounds like it very much sounds like Gorillaz.
Cool.
My problem, I couldn't tell where the James Murphy part was.
He's
the guy from LCD Sound System.
Okay.
And I don't really feel his blueprint on the album as much, which is a bit of a shame. But as it stands, it's a really good track with Gorillaz and Andre 3000.
Like, it's just like a Converse exclusive kind of thing, right?
Yeah, yeah, it's just this one track this Converse project.
Is it to suggest that Gorillaz are going to continue?
No, not necessarily. No.
Yeah.
Andre 3000, though, this is a new story I found, actually did make a statement that I think he's coming out with a solo album this year.
Good, I've been waiting for that album.
And
for
that he
so
said
long.
That he does not think an Outkast album will happen. Or, like, there's not been any talk. Because with any Andre 3000 thing that comes out, people are going to be going, like, oh, maybe Outkast are getting back together. Yeah. And he was like, nah, it's not the thing.
Yeah.
But Andre 3000 solo album could be pretty cool.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, The Love Below, as much as, like, over time, its status is, like, an album I love is kind of diminished, it's still a great, great album.
Yeah, that's an album that I unfortunately was not able to get into as immediately as I would have liked.
And for me, it was so immediate. I loved it, and loved it for so long when I loved it.
It's an album that I really need to go back to.
Yeah.
That and, like, Love Below and Speaker. I don't think I even ever listened
to Speaker Box. Speaker Box is pretty good,
I never
too,
even
yeah.
listened to Speaker Box, I don't think.
Hmm. Yeah, you would probably like Speaker Box.
Yeah.
Which is Big Boy's half of the Love Below / Speaker Box.
Yeah. But that is an album that I really do feel like I need to go back to and really, really examine.
Yeah.
And get into. Yeah, the other thing I checked out was Dr. Dog's new album, Be the Void, which came out, I think, a couple weeks ago.
How is that?
It's a Dr. Dog album.
Yeah, that's sort of what I figured, because, you know, they've like, this must be number 6 or something by now, right?
Probably a little more.
Yeah, and they don't really have the most progressive sound in the world.
No, they don't. I mean, I thought they hit, with their last album, Shame Shame, I thought they hit a really good point of being this sort of, like, very well-produced, sort of retro album, but that has its own vibe,
mm-hmm.
its own feel, and, like, you know, it harkens back to a lot of things. Like, there's one song on there that sounds so much like the band, it's insane.
Interesting.
But, like, it has a very, like, it feels like a Dr. Dog release, and I thought they did a really good job of that with their last one. And this one has sort of been touted as a return to form of sorts, like, because their early albums are pretty weird. Like, they're a lot more lo-fi.
Yeah. Well, like, Toothbrush, which is their first album, is really weird. Easy Beat, I sort of gets them onto the track that they've been on.
Definitely. So this is sort of seen as a return to form. You know, they were trying to get less perfectionist about it and have a little more warts, and the vocals sort of have this sort of rougher quality to them.
I remember the first time I heard Toothbrush, it was, like, the weirdest thing in my ears. Like, I must have been pretty high, but I was just like, it sounded, like, so otherworldly to me.
I was just like, I'd already listened to, like, later Dr. Dog, and when Jordan told me it was Dr. Dog, I was like, huh?
Yeah.
This is Dr. Dog? Weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's sort of, it's very middling, sort of, Be the Void. Like, you know, it's good, there's some good songs on it, I don't really feel the need to revisit it all that much. And I liked where they were at before.
I feel like Dr. Dog and one of those bands who are just gonna have a great compilation one day.
Nah, because they have too many good songs for that. Like, Shame Shame has a lot. Shame Shame and
Fair
Fate
enough.
Both have a lot of really good songs on them, and some interesting things once you delve into them a bit. It's more like they're gonna be a band like Of Montreal is what they're gonna be, where they're a good band who just have too much material.
But Of Montreal are a band who are constantly changing their sound.
Sort of.
No, they like. As much as they've had two of a few albums that are similar, they have pretty consistent, drastic changes.
They've had two really big mix-ups. Like, they had, like, you know, they sort of started off as a retro band, and then with Sunland of Twins, they sort of got more into the electronic side, and then they were sort of delving deeper into that. And they have a couple albums that are, like, really weird avant-garde shit.
Yeah.
But they don't change that much.
I guess.
Of Montreal. And they're one of those things where if you are a big...
I guess they're sound at the core kind of
Yeah, it's, if you're a big Of Montreal fan, I'm sure you can follow each of their albums and be like, well, this is where this changes, and this mm-hmm. is him growing. And, you know, he is an experimental kind of a guy, Kevin Barnes.
Yeah.
But to an average listener, it's sort of interchangeable. And I feel like Dr. Dog are kind of a band like that.
Yeah, well, Dr. Dog definitely are that kind of band.
Yeah. All right. What do we got for news? I did not find very much. Also, we got to wrap this up fairly soon.
All right.
We have 15 minutes for news. Go.
That should be all we need. Steven Tyler says that Aerosmith are working on a new album.
Great.
And that they're back.
Great.
What I find interesting about the story, I guess, is that it's sort of like, you know, it's this whole thing where in the last few years, there's been a really big thing of like 70s hard rock bands releasing albums where they really want to sort of get back to their old sound. And I think part of that can be attributed to sort of the rise in interest in classic rock because of Rhythm Games. And it seems sort of like a response to that, while these hard rock fans want to come back and make albums that sound like they're classics.
I don't think it's a response to that necessarily, as it is a response to, like, first off, you have to remember that these guys were young when they were making their best albums.
Yeah.
So it's first off, guys who are now older, like, wanting to go back and grab their youth again.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And it's also a question, it's also that, you know, nobody lives in a bubble. All the bands, as much as they try to avoid, a lot of bands try to avoid reading reviews and stuff, like, they're still gonna know that, and they still know that, like, their
they
stuff
they know what their reputation
and
is.
And I think it's just a thing of them realizing that they're not, of them wanting that fame again that they once had when they were sort
of on
top of the world.
But you know what, at the same time, though, Aerosmith are an interesting case. Like, they're so unique for 70s hard rock bands because they've maintained a really steady popularity. They were at their commercial peak in the 80s, and they were still pretty huge in the 90s. Like,
that's
the thing
true.
About Aerosmith is that, unlike any other classic rock band, they never stopped having hits.
Except throughout in the 80s 2000s.
And 90s. But the early 2000s had, you know, like, Jaded.
Really?
Which was a
oh,
big
yeah, you're
hit.
Right.
Like, Just Press
you're
Play
right.
was, like, the early 2000s.
You're right.
But I guess since then...
Since then they've petered off. Yeah.
Yeah. And now Steven Tyler's, like, an American Idol host, which makes it even kind of weirder that now is the time they're sort of, you know, they're reuniting with their old producer, Jack Douglas, and just kind of trying to get back to the gritty, hard rock sound of the 70s.
Yeah.
And for a band who have kind of settled into this groove of releasing really polished albums for the last three decades, it's going to be weird to see what happens.
You know what? Aerosmith are a band that, even when they were good, they were kind of inconsistent.
Yeah, like Aerosmith are really inconsistent
album. Even Toys
band.
In the Attic, which is an album that I think is quite good, like, that album... The singles on that album are quite a lot better than a lot of the other songs.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, Aerosmith are a really good singles band.
Well, Aerosmith have two essential albums. There's their 10-song greatest hits, which summed up all the great singles of the 70s. And then in the 80s, they released sort of what was essentially a partner album to that, and it was called Gems.
Yeah.
And it was like, it's just like 12 of their best album tracks, and it works so beautifully and creates basically the perfect two-disc collection of Aerosmith.
Yeah. I can believe that.
Yeah, like that, because it sort of distills their album tracks down to just, like, all their funkiest, most hard rockin' tracks, it works really well.
Yeah, Aerosmith are a band that I don't love all that much, who I have seen live, weirdly.
Yeah.
They're really good live, though, I'll tell you that much.
I bet, yeah.
They just put on a good
they
show.
Gotta.
Joe Perry is a fantastic guitarist,
and
did
you see them when they were on tour with Kiss?
No. No, okay. No, I saw them, they were on tour with, Lenny Kravitz was opening.
Interesting.
Good opener, actually.
Yeah, he must be pretty good live.
Yeah, he's good live. This was years ago, but Aerosmith put on a pretty good show.
Right on.
Joe Perry is a really good guitarist, and I forget who their rhythm guitarist is, like what his name is, and he doesn't get a lot of cred because Joe Perry sort of takes over.
Right.
Guitar-wise, but their rhythm guitarist is super good, too.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, the thing about hard rock bands is that their lead guitarist always kind of gets the credit, but the rhythm guitar is so important in hard rock.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's the same thing with, like, Izzy.
I was just going to say that.
Roses,
like, Slash
yeah.
gets all the credit, but Izzy's the one holding it down.
Not only is the one holding it down, but he was the sort of the main writer of Guns
N' Roses.
Yeah,
that's true, too.
Izzy does not get as much, nearly as much credit as he should.
Yeah, he was the
it's
rock and roll guy. He was really doing it all. All
right, what else you got for me?
The Buffalo Springfield reunion appears to be over, and one of the members of the group is saying it's because Neil Young is fickle, and I think it's just interesting. It's kind of like they were reunited, they were playing some shows, and Neil Young's kind of like, yeah, I'm going to go back and play with Crazy Horse now. See you guys.
Well, because, yeah, what does Neil Young get from fucking... Because Neil Young is one of those guys who just does kind of whatever he wants. And, yeah. Like, what does he get from touring with Buffalo Springfield?
Yeah, people care a lot more about the name Neil Young, and Crazy Horse, for that matter, than anybody cares about the name Buffalo Springfield.
I also don't know any Buffalo Springfield songs except for that one.
Except for Mr. Soul.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know too. Any other Buffalo Springfield songs.
Yeah. So. Nor do I. So, yeah. That's... not really newsworthy, but whatever. So, this is newsworthy, because we can add to the list of insane collaborations with symphonies and rock bands, Kid Rock. And it's kind of an interesting reason that he's doing it, because apparently the Detroit Symphony Orchestra is just, like, going through an economic crisis.
Okay.
And so he's doing the show with them as a benefit to kind of get them some money.
That's good on him to do. That's good intentions.
Yeah.
But...
and, you know, it should be noted that Kid Rock is an extremely important part of my personal musical development. He, you know, as much as, like, he's gone drifted way too far into mainstream country rock territory and has really been off the wagon, when he sort of, like, you know... and I got into his sort of prime rap rock
country stuff
way after.
He's your Limp Bizkit.
But the thing is, I didn't grow up with him. I didn't start liking him until high school, way after his prime. But I discovered that sort of, like, his prime period, and, like, he's so much better than Limp Bizkit. Like, that music still holds up because it's really fun. Like, it mixes hard rock with rap and country in a way. Like, he has a really good band.
I don't know,
band.
Man. Limp Bizkit is pretty fun.
You should listen to Devil Without a Cause.
Limp Bizkit also has a really good band.
Level Without a Cause is fun because it's not angsty. Like, Limp Bizkit is such angsty bullshit.
You're
Kid
right.
Rock was like a classic hard rocker. He just wanted to party and rapped and sang about wanting to party. And, like, that was really sort of the beginning of me discovering the joy of hip-hop and of country. So in that regard, he's really important, as much as I obviously don't listen to it anymore. Like, I maintain that Devil Without a Cause is a really good rock album. And, like, it's probably the best pure hard rock album of the 90s.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm saying it. That's you know, grunge notwithstanding.
That still seems dubious. I
maybe of the late 90s. Maybe I'll fix that a bit and say of the late 90s.
Yeah, okay. Because that was mostly boy bands, so I'll give that to you.
And nu metal.
Maybe I'll give it to you. What about fucking, wait, what did you say, hard rock?
Yeah.
Like, you wouldn't count System in there?
No.
Alright, maybe. Maybe. Yeah, that's fucked up. What is he going to play? He's going to play fucking My Name is Kid Rock with, like...
Firstly, I imagine he will. But secondly, I think it's going to be a lot, you know, it's because he hasn't really done rap rock songs
He's
in a really
long
time.
He's been sort of laid back country.
Yeah, exactly. Country rock, mellow kind of stuff that, you know, fits nicely on the radio.
Anyways,
so that's probably what he's going to do with this.
I think it's a nice sentiment for him to be like, yeah, I'll do this thing and get you guys some money. But who's going to see it? Who's going to go out and see that?
Detroit people who are fans of Kid Rock, which I'm sure there's still a lot of.
I guess so.
In fact, I imagine as he's gotten more mainstream and more, like, you know, country rock radio kind of thing, he probably has a lot more fans than he used to. Because now, you know, because he's, albeit poorly, emulating the sound of the 70s, so, like, a lot of kind of older people are probably kind of into him now. Because he really wants to be Bob Seger. Like, that's kind of the sound he goes for now.
Yeah, right.
He does it really, really poorly, but you know, old people who have their their nostalgic memories of 70s rock would listen to it and not realize that the songs are shitty. They'd just be like, "Sweet, sounds like the music I grew up with."
Yeah, I have a news story. I want.
This sounds like a strange news story.
So Meatloaf believes that he has talked to ghosts, or rather, he believes that he talks to ghosts.
Huh.
Here is the statement. This was a statement, an interview with Shortlist.
Ghosts have been on my mind a lot lately.
Well, yeah, I wanted to bring this up because of that what we were talking about earlier in the week.
Friend of mine who has a ghost friend.
So here's what he's saying. I believe there's something when you die because there are ghosts. I've seen them. I've been around them. Some are just energy left behind, and some are intelligent. I've had conversations with them using a K2 meter, which lets them answer yes or no. I chased one across the room once, and when we were making Bat Out of Hell, I saw a blonde girl in a white dress. I went downstairs and told the guys, there's a groupie up on the balcony. And they go, how would she get up there? Everybody went up, and no one was there. So, yeah. Meatloaf is a ghost whisperer. Apparently.
Interesting. I love Meatloaf, though.
Battered of Hell is a
phenomenal album.
Neutral towards
And Battered of Hell 2 is a really great album. Yeah. Battered of Hell 3 is all right. And he's released some other solid albums in between those three.
Came out with a new album yesterday.
Yeah. Probably not going to listen to it, but...
Battered of Hell 4! I don't actually think... It might
It's not Battered of Hell 4. It's called Hell in a Handbasket.
Okay. Oh, okay. There you go.
Man, Battered of Hell 1 is really just one of my favorite albums ever. That's a great album.
Fair enough.
But that's pretty weird that he talks to ghosts.
Pretty weird, bro. Okay, the other thing that happened was a big songwriter for Elvis Presley, Billy Strange, died at age 81. He was responsible for... co-wrote a lot of songs with Elvis Presley, including A Little Less Conversation, which is a great song.
That is a good song.
He also played guitar on records by Frank Sinatra, Sammy Davis Jr., Wanda Jackson, and the Beach Boys. On Pet Sounds.
Wow.
And his most famous performance was on, you know, the song Bang Bang by Nancy Sinatra.
Yeah, I love that song.
He is the guitar player on that song.
Oh, huh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Because that guitar, like, the guitar that song great, is such a great tone.
Yeah, great tone. So, no one knows why he died or how.
Oh, and he arranged most of Lee Hazelwood's recordings in the 60s.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, Lee Hazelwood is a really great, obscure songwriter who basically is responsible for Nancy Sinatra's fame.
Yeah.
But he did so much cool stuff on his own.
So, the cause of death is unknown. I mean, probably just old age. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming 81's pretty old.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's a bit of a bummer. Bit of a shame.
Oh, hey, Brett McKenzie won an Oscar. That
he did.
Pretty cool.
He did. He won an Oscar.
I forgot about that.
Yeah, he won for Man or Muppet.
Yeah.
Which was no contest. It's a real shame we didn't get to see that being performed on the Oscars, though, man.
It's also a real shame that the Muppets didn't host the Oscars.
Yeah. Billy Crystal was boring as shit.
Yep, should have been Kermit.
Jesus. All right, what else we got? We have 5 minutes.
All right, let's see. What else do I got? Oops. Oh, I think I just exited. Oh, no. That's not good.
You got nothing. That's what you got.
Why isn't the history here? There it is.
There it is. There it is. At the top. Don't look at my porn.
Is there porn here?
I mean, I'm sure if you go down far enough, yeah.
You know, I don't care about any of the other news I have here, so let's just talk about the one news story that we both share,
which
is really exciting.
Oh, yes.
Limp Bizkit, The Bizkit, have signed to Lil Wayne, or Birdman's record label, Cash Money.
Woo!
They're gonna reinvigorate the game.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because, like, Lil Wayne was talking about an interview and basically saying, well, you know, Drake and Nicki Minaj have just been doing so well that we're just going on a spending spree.
Yeah.
And that's why they decided
scooping
to
up Limp Bizkit. Why the fuck not?
Which, you know, and, like, they're the first non-strictly hip-hop act to be a part of Cash Money.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, they're a rap-rock band, so it's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
It makes me wonder if they're sort of, like, if this is a relationship that will last, if they're going to try to sort of push their sound into more of that kind of Cash Money Southern rap direction, or if they're just going to keep going their own path, and if they're going to be collaborating with all of the Cash Money artists now.
Well, the statement that I saw from Fred Durst is pretty much him being like, we don't know exactly what we want to do with the next Limp Bizkit record yet. We're trying to figure it out. But he seems to be pretty excited about Cash Money, being on Cash Money.
Yeah, well, he said, like, we're going to...
Well, he wasn't on a... I mean,
give
I
him
guess,
a rock and roll kick in the ass.
I guess he would have to be, because they were dropped from Interscope last year.
Right,
so,
that's true.
You know. I don't really know how much I actually have to say about this story, other than it's pretty damn funny.
Yeah, it's just, I was like, what? Like, I had to give it a double take, and I had to question if it was just a hoax.
Yeah, that was really the news of the week, I feel.
Yeah.
In a pretty slow news week.
Yeah.
All things considered.
Absolutely.
They usually are, though.
I'm trying to think of new
in the
releases.
In the world of pop music.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of new releases I can talk about. There's a Regina Spektor new release coming out. April 12th, I think. New album.
Cool.
Yeah. See, there's a lot of artists like that where it's sort of like, I feel there's no point talking about their new releases because they consistently release albums anyway. It seems to only be newsworthy when it's like an artist coming back or
I just like announcing.
Yeah, yeah, releases. I know what you mean. Me too.
I mean, Regina Spektor hasn't had an album in a couple of years.
I suppose.
Far was... 2000.
Probably 2010.
2009?
Maybe. It could have been 2009, yeah.
Yeah, that was...
Yeah, there's one interesting thing
And that
thing
was, like,
here.
4 years after... you keep doing this crazy thing
it's,
into my
it's
screen.
It's witchcraft.
I have no idea how you're doing
it. It's my witchcraft.
But it's pretty cool. I like it. Teach me. Teach me how to Dougie.
Well, you know, it's still tab and alt. I don't know. Like, maybe it's the... Maybe it's, like, pressing one before the other. No, I don't know why. It's
all
right. Gone.
Whatever. It's pretty cool. Pretty cool, you guys.
Okay. So... John Peel, who is a legendary BBC personality, basically kind of like, he had a radio show and he, like, there are so, you know, Peel Sessions are his kind of, like, trademark, just all these huge bands who he recorded and released sessions
Beatles
by.
And stuff on. And
did he? Was he around, was he that old? I don't think he was. I think he
I
kind
think
of...
there's a late Peel Sessions Beatles.
Record. I don't know, man. I think I'd know about that.
Maybe,
there's no way that would go over my head this long.
Led Zeppelin. Do they have a Peel session?
They just have BBC sessions. I think it was pre-John Peel.
Maybe I'm being confused then.
Yeah, I think you are. Like, I think John Peel kind of emerged in the late 70s, and he kind of, like, had a lot of the sort of, like, the punk bands come, like, recorded.
And has he still been doing that stuff?
Well, he died a few years ago.
Okay.
But I think he did. Like, he did it through the 90s. You know, he was always kind of, like, doing that and having his radio show and... And so now there's this. There's going to be an online archive of his record collection. He owned more than 25,000 albums, and now we're going to be able to go online and see every album he owned, which is pretty cool because he's sort of such a seminal figure in punk rock and alternative music in general.
And
metal as well.
Yeah, and we're not going to be able to, like, actually listen to them.
I don't know how it works.
Is it an online archive in the way where, like, we can actually, like, just, like, peruse through
we might be able to sample them.
Do it. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Which would be cool. But even being able to look at them and just kind of see stuff and, like, find new music that way would be pretty interesting.
Yeah, that's
true. So I think that's a cool idea to sort of bring his
new
record collection to light.
New, I feel like I need some new avenues for music discovery.
Exactly. And this will be an interesting one.
Yeah. All right. Well, it's just about 9 o'clock, Corey. I got to go to band practice.
All right.
I think that's a good time to wrap it up.
Yep.
So, before we go, if you want to check out the... if you want to sort of follow along to what the kind of stuff we're talking about, we'll be putting up links to all the albums we talked about, stuff on YouTube and whatnot. You can find that at twoloudguys.blogspot.com. Email us stuff. We have not gotten emails in a while.
Yeah, what's with you jerks?
What is with you jerks?
Give us the emails.
Give us the emails.
Get mad at me for calling you jerks. Let's get it on.
Get it on. Get it on.
Oh, let's get it on.
Beautiful. Yeah,
I said that if I ever go to karaoke, that's the song I have to
that's
sing.
That's the one? You need to know it. Like, you gotta go in there and
do
a good
job.
Oh, I
know, let's get it on.
You gotta do a good job if you're doing
it. Well,
but... Well, no, because karaoke with people who are not good at singing is the worst thing for everyone involved. But if you're good, if you take it seriously and you, like, actually go in there and you're good, it's, like, a good time for everyone.
Yeah, it's true. I gotta start practicing my Marvin Gaye impersonation.
Yeah. So anyways, those emails can be sent to twoloudguys@gmail.com. That's two as in the word two, not the letter or number. That's what it is. So twoloudguys@gmail.com. You can send us questions about music, about our personal tastes. You can give us some fucking hate mail. Whatever.
Yeah, talk. Just
talk
just
some
give
shit.
Us
just
more
give
stuff
us
to
shit.
Talk about.
Give us shit. What else? What else? What else? iTunes. We're on iTunes. Subscribe to us. You will get it every week. You'll get our episodes and bloobity blah blah blah. It is February 28th. Have a happy February or a happy March, I guess. We will catch you guys next week on Two Loud Guys.
Bum bum bum.